Today is Ekadasi Maha Mahotsav. I'm sure everybody knows the story of Ekadasi, how it came into being. Huh? You all know that? I'll just go over it quickly. For those of you who don't know, in the beginning of creation, when Lord Vishnu was creating all moving and non-moving living beings, he also created one entity known as Papa Purusha, who was the form of sin, and his duty was to punish those living beings in the universe who disobeyed the laws of God. Prabhupada used to always say that religion means to follow the laws of God. That's all. It's very simple. Dharmam tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam. Simple definition. So, this particular deity or being was created, his limbs and body was created from different kinds of sins, like his head was from the sin of murdering a brahmana. And I think his two eyes were intoxication, and his ears were the sin of having illicit sex connection with the wife of the guru, and his arms were, I think, killing a cow, and his chest was something else, and like that all the way down his body. And his duty again was to punish the living being. So then, after creating Papa Purusha, Vishnu thought that there needs to be somebody to control this fellow. If he runs wild, under what basis will he punish people? There has to be a system of checks and balances. So he created Yamaraj, and everybody who dies, their activities are recorded by Daivanetrena, Karmana, Daivanetrena, by higher authorities. And they, after death, they go to the court of Yamaraj, and court means they're pronounced innocent or guilty of particular sins, and then by the grace of Yamaraj and Papa Purusha, one suffers his sinful reactions. So then after he'd done that, Lord Vishnu decided that he should visit Yamaraj, and of course he mounted Garuda and flew to the abode of Yama. Yama received him very respectfully, seated him on a beautiful golden throne, and they were just about to have a nice satsang, and then Vishnu heard all this screaming and yelling and crying. And he said, "What is that?" And Yama said, "Oh, that's some living beings. They're being punished for their sins." This was in the south. So, actually, this whole story is from the Padma Purana. And it was actually a discussion between Jaimini and Vyasadeva. So Jaimini was one of the sages. When the Vedas were created, it wasn't only Vyasadeva who was working on the Vedas. There were other, even senior sages to Vyasadeva as well as junior. So ultimately, Vyasadeva entrusted a portion of the Vedas I believe it's the Chandogya Samhita, something like that. Not the Chandogya Upanishad, but Chandogya Samhita. He entrusted it to Jaimini. And Jaimini's also the one of the seven, the six Mahajanas who speculated and developed karma mimamsa philosophy. So anyway, this questioning was going back and forth between Jaimini and Vyasadeva, and Vyasadeva was explaining that Vishnu became very compassionate. And so he went to that place where the living beings were suffering, and seeing him coming, all of the sufferers, you know, they began to scream even more loudly, because if you read the fifth canto, whether it's actual or allegorical, but the suffering is real. Whether the suffering is in a subtle body, and it's very real suffering according to the type of sin that one has committed. Now, the fifth canto describes it in so many different ways, like being stitched through with needles. Someone who's very miserly has his body stitched through with needle and thread, and someone who's committed a sin of adultery has to embrace a molten means melted down, but a molten form of a man or a woman, has to embrace that form. So that's painful. White hot, red hot, and you have to embrace, oh darling, you know. That's what you want, that's what you get. So then Vishnu thought that this was a little heavy, so he created, from his own body, he manifested the deity Sri Ekadasi, who was in charge of the lunar 11th day and waxing and waning. And then everybody caught on that by worshiping this expansion of Krishna, they could get free from their sins, and they all started to become liberated. So then Papa Purusha, he became very distressed, and he went to Vishnu, and he bowed down to Vishnu and offered prayers and began to cry and hold the feet of Vishnu. And so Vishnu took compassion upon him and said, what's the matter? What's the problem? I'm pleased with your prayers. What boon can I offer you? So then Papa Purusha described the situation, that you created me to take care of the sinful activities of these people, but they're all worshipping Sri Ekadasi and getting liberated. I can handle any kind of pious activity. Someone may have committed some sins, and they may have done some pious work, and I won't get distracted. I'm not afraid of that pious activity. They still have to suffer for their sin. But I'm totally in fear of Sri Ekadasi, because it's an expansion of yourself, and I can't go anywhere, I can't hide anywhere, I can't do my work anywhere. I'm constantly in fear that Sri Ekadasi will annihilate me, put me out of business anyway. And then he appealed. It was nice in the story, he appeals to Vishnu in an intelligent way. He says that your desire is to manifest your Divya Leela, your transcendental pastimes, in this world. But if all these people get liberated so quickly, there'll be nobody here to have your pastimes with. So, threw in a little transcendental logic. So then Vishnu laughed and said, don't worry. You can reside, you can get free from Sri Kadasi, my form, you'll have nothing to fear. You can reside in food grains. So the idea is that anyone who eats food grains on Ekadasi, all the different kinds of sinful activities that any living being is committing, those reactions to those sinful activities are residing in food grains. And it's explained in the same Padma Purana that someone who eats grains on Ekadasi, each mouthful of grains is equivalent to the sin of killing thousands of brahmanas. So, of course, the advice is that we shouldn't eat grains on Ekadasi. Even if one accidentally follows Ekadasi, he gets great benefit. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was interesting. Up to the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, people were not, at least the general populace, were not taking Ekadasi so seriously. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu stressed it by begging his mother to fast totally from food grains on Ekadasi. And he insisted this, and she followed it. So he made an example of that. And anybody have anything else to add on Ekadasi? Any questions? Yeah. Right. What about distribution of grain prasadam on Ekadasi to non-devotees? How do we rationalize that? Well, I heard a story that Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur authorized prasadam distribution in Mayapur, saying that the distribution, I mean, Bengalis are very particular, and if you're just giving some fruits or vegetables, they're not going to come, they don't consider that a meal. A meal means grains, means cooked grains. So, for the purpose of preaching, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur was prepared to serve meat. He proposed to open a youth hostel in London, and he said, we want people to come and hear, and if they think that they're not serving meat there, how can I stay at that hostel? Then we'll serve meat. Let them come and stay and hear. So I know that's true. So the idea that he might have said that the devotees could distribute grains on Ekadasi as food distribution, and that was preaching and more important than the rule, I don't know. Does anybody know what they do in ISKCON Mayapur? Kichri. Yeah. Not Sabu. Oh, that's right. Oh, that's right. Yeah. Well, yeah, of course, the Gaur Purnima Ekadasi feast is probably, we don't know the origin of that exactly or the philosophy behind that. Theoretically, you're breaking the feast, the fast, but you're not breaking the fast, because the next day after Gaur Purnima again, you have a big feast. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah, Shantipur. Yeah. Every Ekadasi they serve Khichdi to the pilgrims who come. I'm sure they wouldn't do it if it wasn't authorized. But for us, we should follow Ekadasi. I mean, in Bombay, we have a hotel and we have a restaurant that needs money to survive. And we serve a really nice Ekadasi feast at our restaurant. And people love it. People actually come just because, of course, in Bombay, there are many pious Gujaratis who like the idea of having Ekadasi prasad at a restaurant, but still. I think Bengal is a special place. Like I said, people won't come. But I don't know. I guess Jayapataka Maharaj, who's been there for 30-odd years, he must know everything. They must have tried everything. Any other questions about Ekadasi? Yeah. They forget. They paid? Oh, they break the Ekadasi. Oh, they break. Oh, well, anybody, whether it be congregational members or devotees also, sometimes devotees break Ekadasi. It's interesting to note that Ekadasi begins technically from sunrise to sunrise. Our day begins at sunrise when the titi changes. This was informed to me by Shyam Sundar, my godbrother, renowned astrologer. Of course, theoretically, one should not eat anything during the early morning hours, but technically speaking, before sunrise is still not Ekadasi. As far as devotees breaking Ekadasi, actually, the reason I asked that and stay that, because I woke up one morning and there was a piece of Mahaprasadam there near my bed or something. I popped it in my mouth. And I forgot that it was Ekadasi, so I was concerned to see whether I broke Ekadasi or not. Apparently, I didn't break Ekadasi, but I shouldn't have eaten before Mangal Arati or whatever. But if you break Ekadasi, there are two things. One is that you can, it's not good, it's very bad, but you can atone for that by following Ekadasi the next day. Now, I've heard two theories, and I'm not sure which one is true. One is that you follow it on Dvadasi, and the other is that you follow it on Triadasi. The reason that one would not follow Ekadasi, having broken it, one would not follow it on Dvadasi, is that Dvadasi is especially meant to be a feast day. It was not good to fast on Dvadasi. But then I've also seen Prabhupada say fast the next day, so. The other thing you can do, and this is what a lot of people probably should do, is on Bhima Nirjala Ekadasi, if you fast from water completely, then you get the benefit of following all the Ekadasis. Now, it's interesting, this Nirjala Ekadasi, it became a fashion in ISKCON for some time. ISKCON is a very fashionable organization. And it became a fashion to do this Nirjala Ekadasi, but the actual way of doing Nirjala Ekadasi is that you don't take any water the whole day. and then you stay up all night long doing bhajan and kirtan, etc. And then the next day, you carry on with your day. It's not like at just after Mangalarti, you go to bed and take 8 hours rest, which is generally what happened. Devotees would, well, I'm going to do nirjala. Then the next day they would sleep 16 hours. So that's actually cheating. But if you follow Pandava Nirjali Kadasi or Bhima Nirjali Kadasi, it's a nice fast, nice thing to do. Is that okay? Yes. To not eat grains or to eat? Oh, on Dvadasi? Eating, I didn't quite understand, I'm sorry. Oh, yes, there's Ekadasi Purana. I'm not sure about that. Do you know anything about that? What did you heard? Yes, that's true, but why? I think he heard it, but he was asking why. Anybody? It's a research project for someone. Maybe Mayapur, you can find out. You can write to Shyam Sundar. Yes, it's true that you have to break Ekadasi during this particular time, or else you have to continue your Ekadasi until the next Ekadasi, like Maharaj Ambarish. He had a problem that Durvasa Muni had not come back from the river, and he didn't want to take food before his guest, but if he didn't break the Ekadasi during the right period, he would have had to fast another full year. So, of course, he took water, which was breaking the fast and not breaking the fast. And Durvasa Muni could understand, being a mystic, that he had eaten. And then the fun began. But why it is so, you're asking why, I don't know. I would assume it's the same principle as Maharaj Ambarish, that if you don't break the fast between the two timings of Purana, then you have to fast till the next Ekadasi. Or you lose the benefit of your Ekadasi either way. Okay. Bhagavad Gita, we're a little late getting started here. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We're reading from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, The Perfection of Renunciation, text 54. Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Nasochati Nakankshati Samasarveshu Bhuteshu Madbhaktim Labhate Param. Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Na Shochati Na Kankshati Samasarveshu Bhuteshu Madbhaktim Labhate Param. Bhutaha, being one with the Absolute. Prasanna Atma, fully joyful. Na, never. Shochati, laments. Na, never. Kankshati, desires. Samaha, equally disposed. Sarveshu, to all. Bhuteshu, living entities. Madbhaktim, my devotional service. Labhate, gains. Param, transcendental. One who is thus transcendentally situated at once realizes the supreme Brahman and becomes fully joyful. He never laments or desires to have anything. He is equally disposed toward every living entity. In that state, he attains pure devotional service unto me. Purport. To the impersonalist achieving the Brahma-Bhuta stage, becoming one with the Absolute, is the last word. But for the personalist or pure devotee, one has to go still further to become engaged in pure devotional service. This means that one who is engaged in pure devotional service to the Lord is already in a state of liberation called Brahma Bhuta, or oneness with the Absolute. Without being one with the Supreme, or the Absolute, one cannot render service unto Him. We hear about this oneness all the time, and we are fortunate that Lord Chaitanya has given us this Ved-Abed conception. And the example, the nice example used by Jiva Goswami is that of a green bird and a green tree. They are one. When the green bird flies into the green tree, they are one. You can hardly see the difference. If a parrot flies in, a green parrot flies into a green tree in Juhu. You see all those parrots? Yeah? From the guest house, they're just outside the guest house, there are so many trees and really beautiful green parrots, and sometimes it's hard to see them because they merge right with the tree. But then, all of a sudden, the green bird will fly out of the tree again. So he's one with the tree, but at the same time, he is an individual. So similarly, the devotee becomes one in purpose with God. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. In that way, he becomes one with the Lord. But at the same time, he is an individual person who can render devotional service. If one is still thinking that he is independent of the Lord, there's no question of rendering service to the Lord. In the absolute conception, there's no difference between the served and the servitor. Yet the distinction is there in a higher spiritual sense. So, different examples are given. The sun, planet, the deity of the sun and the sunshine. They're all the sun. But still there's a distinction. And there's the Supreme Lord who is being served. He's the object of worship. And he is Brahman. He is spirit. But he's not receiving service from inanimate matter. He's receiving service from jivatmas who are willing, thinking, feeling entities. They're also Brahman. They're also spirit, like a particle of gold and a gold mine. There's no distinction between the gold, just the quantity is different. So there's the servitor and the served, and they're one, but at the same time, they're different. In the material concept of life, when one works for sense gratification, there is misery. But in the absolute world, when one is engaged in pure devotional service, there is no misery. The devotee in Krishna consciousness has nothing for which to lament or desire. This is, again, Krishna's first teaching to Arjuna. He teaches him about reincarnation, but he also strongly, in a number of verses, castigates or chastises Arjuna. Almost calls him, O scion of Bharata, O son of such a great tradition. Kutastva kashmalamidam vishame samupastitam anarya justam asvargyam. It is not like someone who is in the Aryan lineage. Someone who is an Aryan like you is supposed to know the progressive value of human life. Someone is supposed to know about spiritual subject matters. He should not be lamenting for the body. And in so many ways, natvam sochitum arhasi, therefore you should not lament. He says, even if you think that the body is the self, still you should not lament. Because every day, Prabhupada gives the example, every day chemicals are being dumped into the river from a factory. And nobody laments the loss of those chemicals. There's no widows there weeping or, you know, it's just chemicals. Nobody worries. So even if you think that you're the self is just a bag of chemicals, even if you're an atheist or a materialist, still there's no need to lament. So someone on the Brahma-Bhuta platform who actually can see spiritually, has spiritual vision, has transcendental eyes, Dadami Divyam Te Chakshu, Krishna tells Arjuna, I will give you divine eyes by which you can see me. When your eyes are anointed with the ointment of prema or love, then you can see me. So even someone who has that, especially someone who has that spiritual vision, they have nothing to lament about. And they have no aspiration to gain anything. They know that everything in the material world is false. This is, again, we were talking about this yesterday, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu instructs Sanatana Goswami, actually, that he says, Dvaite Bhadra Bhadra Gyan. So Bhadra and Abhadra means auspicious, and Abhadra means inauspicious. Bhadra Abhadra. So he says, Dvaite, there's no dualism here. Dvaite Bhadra Bhadra Gyan. Sarva Manodharma is only a mental concoction. Manodharma. Dharma means religion and mana means mind. It's just a mental concoction. A bhala, a manda. This is good, this is bad. A sub brahm. Brahm means illusion or it means a mistake. So it's a mistake to think that way because this material world, the whole material world is asat. It is temporary. It is not real in the sense that it is not permanent. Nasato vidite bhavo nabhavo vidite sataha. It's not substantial. It can't give you any lasting value. All it can do is give you prayas, immediate gratification. But to get involved in calculating this is good and this is bad, that is the business of a sense gratifier. He makes plans, and for his plan making, he's got to think, well, this would be good and this would be bad. So he makes this kind of calculation. But for a transcendentalist, he knows it's all false. There's nothing good here in the material world. There's nothing bad, there's nothing good, or he thinks it's all bad because it's not spiritual. It's not, it won't, getting involved here is against my self-interest. Natevidu svardhagatim hi Vishnu. My self-interest. I want to do the best for myself. We're all self-interested. Every day, at every moment, let's be honest, we're all thinking about number one, me. But we should be intelligent and understand that me, it means spiritual. I am a spiritual being, so we have to pursue that if we're actually self-interested. And someone who's on that platform, prasanatma, he's always joyful. Prasanna atma. The atma is prasanna. The self is joyful. Now, especially Brahman is a platform where it's more Brahmananda. The bliss of Brahman is simply, is something like the cessation of pain. And sometimes we do a little dramatization of this, just to illustrate the principle. Have I ever done this here? I've done it before with, maybe I should just do it with Mayapur. Shall I show you what Brahmananda is like? Would you like to experience Brahmananda? Yeah? Anybody would like? Okay, Mayapur, come here. No, no, you have to experience. Now. You're supposed to say, ah. He's not a very good actor. The idea is when pain ceases, the relief that you get, that's Brahmananda. But it's not the bliss of Krishna consciousness. But still, one's joyful that Sridhar Swami isn't twisting his arm anymore. There's some joy there. He does not lament for any loss or gain because he is full in the service of the Lord. He has no desire for material enjoyment because he knows that every living entity is a fragmental parcel of the Supreme Lord and therefore eternally a servant. He does not see in the material world someone as higher and someone as lower. Higher and lower positions are ephemeral, temporary. And the devotee has nothing to do with ephemeral appearances or disappearances. For him, stone and gold are of equal value. This is the Brahma-Bhuta stage, and this is attained very easily by the pure devotee. Now, practically speaking, in devotional service, although we understand But because we have to preach within society, we do make distinctions. Because we are attempting to become Madhyamadhikaris, or we are Madhyamadhikaris, therefore we see that there are innocent beings and there are demons, and we discriminate between them. And we also see that there are different kinds of devotees within the temple. There are some devotees who are just, it's like a hospital, some patients are just entering the hospital for treatment, they're just starting out. Some are under the care of a doctor and getting regular treatment, and some are being discharged. They're free from sickness now. Not everybody in the hospital is exactly the same. So devotees also are intelligent to discriminate in that way. But in regards to money, I mean, Prabhupada was very practical. He said that if you go to a Mayavadi guru and you put money on the table, he's actually a Mayavadi. If he's just a cheater, well, that's another thing. But anyway, Prabhupada said if you go to some gurus, and he might have been thinking of someone in particular, but he did went to this, if you put the money on the desk, the guru will go like this, turn his nose up. Not interested. I'm detached from money. I'm transcendental. The Prabhupada said, if you put money in front of me, I will go like this. Because we have so many good plans to build a restaurant, to install a new altar, to do so many things, right? What's preventing us? We need chips. So that's the difference between yukta vairagya and phalgu vairagya, false renunciation. And this stage is attained very easily by the pure devotee, the Brahma Buddha stage. In that stage of existence, the idea of becoming one with the Supreme Brahman and annihilating one's individuality becomes hellish. This was stated in a verse by Prabodhananda Saraswati. Who's Prabodhananda Saraswati? Well, we talked about this yesterday. Yeah. Good guess. Actually, it was a bad guess. Gopal Bhatta. Not only was he the father of Gopal Bhatta, he was he wasn't the father, he was the uncle. But he was a very eminent Sanskrit scholar, and the whole family was were in the Ramanuja Sampradaya, and they were worshipping Rangaji, Ranganath, in Rangakshetra, which is the largest temple in India. And there's a nice story about how that temple was built, too. But anyway, it involved some mystic cities and some dacoity and intrigue and... Anyway. So Prabodhananda Saraswati was there when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came. He was actually a householder. And the whole family were in the line of Ramanujacharya. They were Ramanuja Vaishnavas. So Gopal Bhatta, he was a 10-year-old boy at that time. He was the son of Venkata Bhatta, and he got the mercy. Actually, the whole family, Venkata Bhatta, his wife, his son, they all became great devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Prabodhananda Saraswati also. He later on took sannyas, and he also became a great devotee of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he wrote a book called, among other books, one book he wrote was called Chaitanya Chandramrita. And in that book, he talks here about this. He says, Kaivalyam, that merging in Brahman, which is known as Kaivalya, or oneness, becoming one with the Supreme, For a devotee, that thought is Narakayate. Naraka means hell. Where's Narakara? No, that's different. But Narak or Naraka means hell. So for a devotee, the idea of merging with Brahman is like suicide, spiritual suicide. Why should I, be a lump of sugar when I can taste a lump of sugar? Why should I, try to become God when I can love God? When I can have a juicy relationship with God? Why should I become God? What's the value in it? No practical value. Better to have a juicy relationship with a person. A transcendental relationship, free from misery, free from anxiety, totally beyond the material cosmos, but there's the lover and the beloved. There are two, as Madhvacharya, sitting like this with two fingers up. He's not saying peace, brothers. He's saying two. So he says, Kaivalyam Narakayate, and then here, Tridasapur Akasha Pushpayate. Tridasapur refers to the heavenly planets. For a devotee, all the allurements, drinking soma ras, dancing with apsaras, having big palaces, for a real devotee, this is simply Akasha Pushpa. It's an illusory enjoyment as much as flowers in the sky. Akash, Pushpa. As much as you get flowers in the sky, this kind of enjoyment in the heavenly planets is definitely not worth struggling for, striving for. It's also temporary. Abrahma bhuvanaloka punarvartino Arjuna. Everybody has to die. Even in the heavenly planets, they have to suffer. And the idea of attaining the heavenly kingdom becomes phantasmagoria. Akasha Pushpa. Phantasmagoria. And the senses are like serpent's teeth that are broken. So generally the senses are the cause of our suffering. The sansparsa jabboga, the contact of the senses and the sense objects. And we just get entangled, tied up in a knot. We know it's not our real self. We know it's not happiness. We know it's not ultimately satisfying. But it's like we're caught. We just do what everybody else does. People do not think for themselves. People do not think. That's the problem. They just follow their nose, follow their tongue, follow their genital. They just follow their senses without really thinking. You go up to anybody on the street and ask them, you try it. Ask your friends if they're not devotees. You ask them, what is the ultimate purpose in your life? What philosophy, what logical philosophy do you have about the ultimate goal in life? And 9 times out of 9, thought I was going to say 10, didn't you? They don't have any philosophy. It's amazing how little people think, and yet they laugh at us. It bewilders me more than any other thing in the world. How people can be so stupid. So, anyway, this idea of the senses and the sense objects, Prabodhananda Sarasvati says, Durdan tendriya kalasar prothkata dangstrayate. Prothkata dangstrayate. It's like the senses, when they're engaged in devotional service, even though they're potentially dangerous, but like a snake has a sack of poison, and a deadly snake has a sack of poison that he goes on building up this sack of poison. And when he strikes you, he cuts your skin with his teeth. He has little teeth, sharp little teeth. And, he makes a, a cut, and then he squirts the poison in the cut. So if the teeth are broken or extracted, dangstraite means they're extracted, then you're not in danger from the sack of poison. You're still, you have senses, but they're nicely engaged in a higher occupation, and even though you're eating prasadam and relishing it, but that's not going to drag you to hell. Even though you're creating children for Krishna and getting a sexual experience, but that's not going to drag you to hell. That is part of devotional service. All of the senses can be engaged in different ways in serving Krishna, but it must be done according to Shruti, Smriti, Purana, Pancharatra, Vidim Vidyaikantiki, Harir Bhakti, Utpat, Yaeva Kalpate. If it's not done according to scripture, then it's just a disturbance to you and to society. Devotional service is a science. We have to go through the parampara, we have to go through the shastra, and we have to think about devotional service. It's a practice. It requires constant attention. You get better and better and better about it if you relax, if you become casual. Then you don't make progress. You don't make much progress. You have to engage in devotional service and understand what you're doing and how you're making progress. At that time, then, there's no fear of the snake, the broken teeth. So the material world is miserable for the infected person, but for a devotee, the entire world is as good as Vaikuntha, or the spiritual sky. The highest personality in the material universe is no more significant than an ant for a devotee. Such a stage can be achieved by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, who preached pure devotional service in this age. So, even in this life, sometimes we're so accustomed to physical things that we need physical proof. In other words, when is my hair going to stand on end? Or when are my arms going to elongate? Or you see people melting all over the place. Devotees look like spastics or something. That's not the test. And we are, by my calculation, devotees are humble people. And sometimes they also forget what it was like in the material world. But when you're engaging in devotional service regularly, you get some pleasure which can't be compared with anything within your material experience. You should even stop trying to compare it. Just relish devotional service. Be joyful. Be happy and go forward and grow. Follow the process nicely and you'll automatically grow. Year after year, day after day, you'll grow in devotional service. Your mind will become free from anxiety. You'll become detached from the material world. You'll receive transcendental knowledge. You'll be inspired to preach. You'll be satisfied with the necessities of life given to you. And you'll be able to pass away from this world in a transcendental condition. So, stop there. Are there any questions or comments? Granthraj Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai.